Every leader says culture matters, but here's the truth. Most of them can't really define it. They can't measure it, and they definitely can't manage it. Imagine being able to see your company's culture in real time, to be able to measure burnout, alignment, psychological safety, all with the same precision as your financial reports. Today's guest, Bronson Taylor, has done just exactly that. He's the co-founder and CEO of Workplace.io and the author of this great book, The Science of Culture, Defining and Measuring Culture in the Age of AI. Bronson is leading the revolution in how organizations understand themselves and using AI and natural language processing to make the invisible visible. I'm Jim Ketting. I help leaders measure the health of the organizations through the ultimate leadership audit, because you can't mitigate risk if you haven't measured it, and you can't measure it unless you clearly defined it. So today, we're going to have a deep dive into the science of culture, where data meets humanity. So welcome. I'm so excited, Bronson. I'm glad to have you here today.
Jim, thank you so much for having me. I can't wait to get into the awesome topics that we're going to cover.
Yeah, I was just so excited about having you on today. Can you kind of give the audience a little bit of background of who you are?
Yeah, so I'm just a big geek. That's the cliff notes.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've been obsessed with technology, you know, since there was an internet. I mean, I remember the K dial-up modems and the sound they would make, and that's just music to my ears to this day. But I've been on the internet since there was an internet, and I've always just trying to figure out, what's the next frontier? Where's it going? How can I create technology for good, right? That's kind of one of the ethos that I live by, is when you have this powerful ability to do what you want with technology, you want to do something meaningful in the world. And so really, that's the through line of my entire story. I've started a lot of companies, mentored a lot of companies. I've been a part of Techstars. I ran Giant, which is a global consultancy that you're familiar with. And now I'm the CEO and co-founder of Workplace. But really just always asking the question, how can we build technology to do good in the world?
Love that. I love that. Now, I got your book. I started reading it, and your book starts off with radically different offices. One feels alive and one feels heavy. And I've walked into both kinds. And you can feel it before you meet anyone. What are we really seeing in those moments?
Yeah. See, the thing is, a lot of people don't have a good working definition of culture, but they know it when they see it. Right. So I'll give you an example. If you walk into an organization, you walk into the office on Monday morning and you're greeted with a smile, and your manager asks about your weekend, not just about the project update, right? You get into a meeting, and in that meeting, there's collaboration, there's purpose. You know what you're meeting about, you know why you're meeting. Every voice is heard from, right? There's a disagreement, but it's handled with care, with empathy, with love for the truth, not for the place of the individual in the hierarchy. And when you go home from an organization like that, you feel like life matters. You feel like work matters. You feel like you spent your day doing something important that you're proud of and you want to do it again tomorrow. Doesn't mean it was easy. It doesn't mean there wasn't things along the way that you had to figure out, that you had to work through. But overall, there's a sense of joy in just the way you conduct your work life. But then you can look at the opposite, and it's also true. An organization where Monday morning they come in and they want to get to their desk as quick as possible without talking to anybody. They want to get their headphones on as quick as they can get them on so they can get in their own little world and just not be bothered. You might pass by a desk and see a manager berating somebody publicly because they think that's what good managers do. They make sure that everyone's a little bit afraid. And then when you finally get into that Monday morning meeting, everything's just a little bit off. Most people don't have a voice that gets to be heard from. A few people dominate the conversation. They act like they want input, but they really just want a rubber stamp. They want you to approve their ideas. They don't actually want the best of what you bring. And if you speak out and speak out too often, you're going to find that out the hard way and you learn to keep your mouth shut, right? And when you go home at the end of the day and you're talking to your significant other, you know, you're asking, you're saying, is this the place for me? Should I be here? Is this how I'm going to spend the next X years of my life? And before you know it, you're scrolling on LinkedIn. You're trying to figure out where the opportunities are, who's hiring, what is happening in town that might be interesting to go see what they're up to. And even though we don't have a working definition of culture yet, it's obvious that what's different about those two organizations is their culture. I've said nothing about their product or service. I've said nothing about whether they're public or private. I've said nothing about how many employees there are. I've only defined things that are very cultural. And yet instantly we know, oh, that first office is one where I want to be, and that's a good culture. And the second one is a place I'd rather avoid, and that's a bad culture. So it's really obvious what culture is when you see it, even though a lot of people haven't really thought about what is culture.
Oh, that's really good. Now, you describe culture as how we do things around there. Now, that sounds really simple, but really profound. Can you help me unpack that a little bit? What does that mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of times, if you get into the literature, there is so many definitions of culture floating around, some good, some not so good. A lot of them are very complicated, though. And one of the things I found, actually in this book right here, a book by Dill and Kennedy, and it's called Corporate Cultures. And in this book, they actually, and this came out in the early 80s, by the way, so this has been around a long time, but they define culture as how we do things around here. And when I first came across that definition, it was like a light bulb went off. I was like, yes, that is what culture is. It's how we do things around here. And the reason why that definition has so much power, even though it's simple, is that it correlates culture to behavior. See, that's the big insight. Culture is the behaviors that you allow, that you repeat, and that you reinforce. And so if you walk into a group and they allow certain behaviors, they reinforce certain behaviors, and that's the way they do things around there, that is their culture. And I like that because it gets away from culture being aspirational. It gets away from culture being mission, vision, values. It gets away from culture being empty words that we say. Culture is actually all of the micro interactions, all of the micro behaviors added up over time. That's your actual culture. And when you define culture like that, it brings to life something that felt either fuzzy and ephemeral or academic. It brings it to life because anyone can say, that's how they do things around there. Or when you think about your own organization, you can pinpoint, that's how we do things around here. And it filters into every part of the organization. So it filters into how meetings are ran, right? Who speaks, who doesn't speak, what are the topics, how does collaboration happen or not happen? All of that is just how we do things around here. Those are all behaviors, how we treat each other as employees. Do we gossip? Do we play politics? Do we try to backstab? Do we try to take credit? Or do we actually want the group to get credit for the breakthrough? Do we want to hold other people up? Those aren't just fuzzy cultural things. That's behavior. That's how we do things around here. So if you want the simplest, but I think also the most powerful definition of culture, it's simply how we do things around here.
I love that. That is so profound. Now, when you started actually measuring culture, did the data confirm what leaders already sensed, or was it a surprise to a lot of them?
Yeah. So we went on this journey because we were building a product to measure culture, but we first had to define culture, and we defined it through how we do things around here, the actual behaviors, like we said. And when we talked to people that led organizations, executives, HR manager, heads of people, just bosses at all layers, they couldn't put their finger on it, but they knew it was behavioral. They knew it was something to do with the way that they actually did things. So we did a deep dive into the literature. And what we were looking for is what metrics actually depict how we do things, right? And so that was kind of the lens that we went to the literature with. What metrics would actually measure how actual work happens? And one of the things we found is that there are metrics that really do define how we do things around here. And when we took those metrics back to the organizations, we took them back to the heads of HR, to the CEOs and COOs and so many other people inside of organizations. When we took those metrics back, we said, does this sound like culture to you? And we would rattle off these metrics that we found. And they said, yeah, that's exactly what culture is. Because if these metrics are up and to the right, then our culture is up and to the right. And I would do this thought experiment. I would say, can you imagine all six of these metrics? And we can get into what those six are and we could talk about them when you want. But I would say, can you imagine all six of those metrics being really good, going in the right direction, being exactly what you want, and yet somehow your culture being bad? And the answer was no, they really couldn't imagine that. And then I would ask the inverse. I would say, can you imagine these six metrics all being bad, but somehow you having a good culture? And they would, well, no, that's impossible. How could all these metrics be bad and our culture be good? Because these metrics are getting at the daily behaviors. These metrics are getting at what we allow, what we repeat, and what we reinforce. Those become the things that show up in these metrics. So yeah, we found in the literature durable metrics that line up to exactly what executives were saying. Now, they didn't have the language for it, right? I mean, that's our job, you know, as business leaders and as thought leaders, we have to come up with the language to help them. So they couldn't pinpoint it, they couldn't name it, but when it was presented to them, they said, this is a perfect fit. This is the measurement of culture. So yeah, there was a lot of agreement between the literature and the practice of running organizations.
Well, this is really good. You know, one of the things when I go in and talk to people and we talk about culture and everything else, it's so misunderstood. People don't understand it. They get a feeling of what good culture is and what bad culture is. And I will go kind of a little different aspect. I'll say, good is your leadership here. And I said, well, how do you measure that? And how do you define that? And how do you think about that? Because it's a risk. There's a lot of risks in having a bad culture, but you cannot, if you don't identify the risk, if you don't measure the risk, you can't mitigate the risk. And so if we don't actually have a good idea and have the data behind it, it's really hard to just throw darts at it. And it's very difficult to do that. So I see this when I do any type of audit work. If it's not defined, I can't fix it. And I've seen it firsthand. CEOs walk into a room and they feel the tension. They just can't pinpoint why. And what's amazing about what you've developed, and it's like walking into a dark room and your data flips the lights on and everyone's like, oh, wow, this is incredible. So I think I'm excited. We're going to get to what you're doing and everything. And I'm real excited for you to show that. But before we do, I want to talk a little bit about something you wrote about. It's called a counterfeit culture. Those glossy mission statements on the ping pong tables, the Hawaiian shirt Friday. Why do leaders keep failing at this?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. People don't know how to define culture. They don't know how to measure culture the same way they have a hard time defining and measuring leadership, the work that you do, right? And when they don't have a good working definition and they don't know how to measure it, they fall back to whatever feels natural or what they've seen someone else do. And so what feels natural to an executive when they think they have a culture problem is to come up with mission, vision, values and to push them out, right? And so what that means in practice is they sit around for a couple of weeks with other people that think they're a little more important than they probably are. And they try to figure out what is our mission. And they try to come up with a perfect sentence, a perfect paragraph. And then they get that check mark. And then they say, okay, well, what's our vision? And they come up with a vision statement. And then they, okay, we got that. Now let's come up with our values. And they list out a handful of values. And then they might put them in a handbook. They might send them out in an email. They might have the CEO get up and do, you know, a quarterly town hall meeting and say, okay, everybody, this is our mission. This is our vision. This is our values. They run to Kinko's. They get the copiers going. They come back. They hand out everything. And they think they've actually done something, right? They think that they've actually made a step toward creating culture. Now, mission, vision, values are good, right? I create them for my own company. I'm not saying those are bad things in and of themselves. But remember that definition of culture. It's how we do things around here. So if those mission, vision, values don't actually make their way into the micro behaviors of everyone in the organization, then you've created a counterfeit culture. And so it's kind of, when I went to New York, you know, you go to certain streets, and certain streets, they have all the knockoffs, right? You can get the knockoff Louis Vuitton. You can get the knockoff Nikes. I'd be lying if I said I didn't buy some knockoff stuff there, right? It's fun, but we know it's not the real thing, right? And so what these counterfeit cultures do is they try to convince you it's the real thing because they've thought about it. They've put some words down on paper. They've said it out loud a number of times. But then there's this disconnect between the actual behavior of the people they're leading and all of this fancy material they created. So what they ended up doing, even though they didn't mean to, is they created a counterfeit culture because there was a misalignment between all those fancy words and the behavior of the people that they wanted to actually follow those words. You know, you think about values for a second, and we think that we can just decide our values. Like, oh, I'm just going to list them out on a piece of paper, and now those are our values. And it's like, no, doesn't quite work that way. Yeah, start by putting them on a piece of paper. Now you've got to live them. You've got to embody them. You've got to reinforce them at every step, at every layer, at every level of the organization. You have to actually become those values. And now you're doing the hard work of creating culture. But when you just come up with the values, you've done almost nothing. But it allows us to get a quick check mark mentally, right? As an executive, you think, okay, I've taken that off my list. I now have the culture thing figured out, because I figured out mission, vision, values, when really the work of culture is every day, all day, every conversation, every interaction, every meeting, every single thing that every person does collectively becomes the culture. So if you want to do the hard work of moving away from a counterfeit culture to a real culture, it's going to take so much more time and energy, but it's so much more worth it at the same time.
I love that. That's really good. Now, I've been in offices and I've seen the big sign that says, we're one big family. And the employees are thinking, yeah, a dysfunctional family that needs a little therapy.
Maybe. That's right.
Once you strip away the counterfeit and really understand what's true, that's where your science comes in. And you've distilled decades of research, I think, into six measurable dimensions: burnout, psychological safety, conflict, engagement, alignment, and execution risk. Why those six?
Yeah. So we started by looking at actually a lot more metrics because, again, we were trying to find which metrics best depict everyday behavior. Okay. So that was really the filter, because we knew that if a metric depicted everyday behavior, then it would depict culture. So we didn't go in asking what metrics sound cool, which metrics do we think would be fun to measure. We went in saying which metrics correlate to real behavior inside the organization and real behavior that matters. And in looking at the literature and then in kind of having this reflexive equilibrium with the executives, and then going back to the literature and going back to the executives, these were the six that came up on conversations over and over and over. And they're also very prevalent in the literature as well. And so those six, I mean, do you want to go into kind of what those are and what they mean? Because, I mean, we can geek out for a second if you want to.
Let's do this. But first, I want to ask you, what do leaders underestimate the most?
That's a really good question. Probably psychological safety. If I have to pick one that they underestimate. Everyone kind of know, they all know burnout matters. It has a lot of traction, right? We don't want people burn out or we feel burnt out. Execution risk, just because the word execution is in it, they think it matters because everyone wants more execution, more productivity. So they think, okay, execution risk, let's not have that. But of all of them, psychological safety is the one, and this is my personal opinion, right? Where I think it's underestimated the most. And I'll tell you why. Because psychological safety is the ability for a group of people to be open and honest without fear of what's going to happen, right? That's the simplest way to think about it. So when you're in a meeting and you're trying to solve a difficult problem, you need to hear the truth from everyone, because the truth for how to solve that problem might be in the head of someone that is not that influential, not that talkative, right? Not that able to formulate their ideas into words, not that captivating. And yet they might be the only person in the room with the dead on right answer to the thing we're trying to solve. And so if you have low psychological safety, that person doesn't have the ability to say what they're thinking, because maybe the conversation moves too fast. Ideas are shot down too quick. There's harm in being wrong. So you're like, well, I keep my job if I don't say anything. But if I say something and I'm wrong, there's repercussions, right? But when you build a team that has true psychological safety, you're creating an environment where you get the full brain power of all the employees sitting around the table, not just the people who are the best at positioning themselves as having the right answer. And so one of the things we do in our own organization is I pull out of people constantly and I tell them, I want you to disagree. It doesn't mean I'm going to agree with you, but I want you to disagree with me so that I'm forced to formulate a logical response. And then you can tell me if that actually persuades you or not. And in this dialogue of actually pulling out of people and having this responsible debate, you get to insights and you get to decisions that a lot of organizations will never get to. They're being outcompeted by other organizations because other organizations have higher psychological safety, and they're actually finding ways to get to the answer quicker, better, more efficiently because they've let go of politics and they've let their guard down, and there's a really high psychological safety. So that's my personal opinion.
I think that's brilliant. I think that's brilliant. You know, the one that got me was the execution risk metric. That really caught my attention. When I go through and I audit leadership, I look at, you know, that survey, you know, and it's incomplete. You know, I look at communication, trust, alignment, and the capacity to execute. And it's amazing how data can reveal the dysfunctions that leaders feel, but they can't articulate. Now, when you show those numbers to an executive team, what's the kind of reaction that you get?
Yeah. So right now our product is in beta. So we're using it internally. So I'm going to tell you the response that we got from it, right?
Okay.
So we, in about 30 days, we're going to start rolling in our first users on it. But right now, when we see the data, sometimes it fits our model of the world and we're like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Sometimes it gives us something new we have to work through and think about, right? And that's really where what we want to happen. We want the data to tell us something that makes us think, well, why is that? And how can we improve? And why is that the way it is? And so we actually like it when the data is off a little bit. And so, yeah, there's a number of examples from our personal data of where we're like, oh, okay, that's good insight that we needed to actually improve. I've even gotten personal leadership guidance from our own software that I've taken to heart.
Well, that's great. Well, I want to talk, you know, I want to kind of segue into the AI breakthrough, because I think this is what just blew my mind when I saw you speak a couple weeks ago. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is a game changer for everyone. So I want to talk a little bit about the AI. Now, you say it turned into, you turned a concept, digital exhaust, into insight. And for those not living in the AI world, what does that mean?
Yeah. So let's back up even a level before that. So in AI, you know, AI is this kind of nebulous term. And for a lot of people, it just means ChatGPT. That's become what they mean by AI, right? But AI has actually been a well-defined discipline for decades. I mean, we've been working on it for a number of years. And one of the parts of AI that doesn't get as much attention as generative AI, see, generative AI gets all the hype right now because it's generating new text, it's generating video, it's generating images. But there's a part of AI that doesn't get as much hype called natural language processing. And that's the AI's ability to actually understand human language, right? And here's why that's such a breakthrough, because AI with natural language processing, or NLP as they call it, it knows when you say a certain sentence, what that means, right? Not just the definition of the words. It's not just taking the words and going to Webster. It's actually looking at the context of those words in the context of that sentence, in the context of your workflow, and it knows what those words mean for the organization. And so AI has been a breakthrough because my contention is that the biggest clues for our culture is embedded in our language, right? The words we use, right? The people we allow to speak, the people that don't get to speak, the amount of words this person uses versus this person, right? The kinds of words we use, the tone of the words that we use, the context that we use the words in. Language is the programming language of humans. Like, this is our programming language. So when you can take an AI and natural language processing and take the code of humanity, which is language, and then say, no, now with technology, we actually understand that language and what it means. That means we can finally measure culture, because culture is embedded in the language that we use. So that's why it's such a breakthrough, because until a computer can understand human language, you can never fully capture culture in a diagnostic that's really robust. But if AI can measure language, it opens up so many possibilities with measurement in things like culture. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, that's huge. That word, you know, digital exhaust, you know, every Slack message, email, comment leaves clues. And you're getting a lot of that from those things. And I want you to talk a little bit about that. And then a little bit about, you know, where's the line between insight and surveillance?
Absolutely. Something we had to think about a lot. Yeah. Okay. So first, let's back up to digital exhaust.
Okay.
So whenever we're doing work, we're using language, right? That's our programming language. And we're trying to do things like get a project done, right?
Okay.
But when we do that, we're actually leaving digital exhaust clues about other things, right? So take a car, for example, and it has exhaust. The goal of a car is not to create exhaust. The goal of a car is to get from point A to point B. But in so doing that, it leaves exhaust. Same thing in an organization. Your goal isn't to leave digital exhaust. Your goal is just to get the project from point A to point B. But in so doing that, you leave all this exhaust behind you, all this language that can tell us, are you burnt out? Is there psychological safety? Is this employee engaged? Is this team engaged? Is this team aligned? See, all that stuff is in the digital exhaust. All the language that you're using to move the car from A to B, it wasn't the goal to create all this exhaust, but you created it nonetheless. And so that's what digital exhaust is. And so AI is able to look at the digital exhaust inside of Slack, inside of Microsoft Teams, inside of a Zoom transcript, all the places where collaboration is already happening. It can look at that digital exhaust and then actually say, okay, this is what it means for the culture. This is what it means against the metrics that describe how we do things around here, which is our culture. And so that's how digital exhaust kind of fits into it. Digital exhaust isn't the thing, but it's the thing with all the clues, because of the projects that we're trying to move from A to B. Now, you mentioned, you know, surveillance. Does this get into Big Brother territory, right?
Well, yeah, and I'm looking at insight versus surveillance, you know, so I think there's a line between there.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one of the things when we first started developing our product, it was more surveillance than it is now. And we actually pulled back the reins on it so that it could be far less surveillance and only used in situations where it can lift up the culture. So one of the things that we talk about is we're not trying to call out people with when we look at this data. So what that means is the software, it doesn't actually store what any individual says. So your data is not in some database somewhere. So we can't pull up, Jim said XYZ. We don't know Jim said XYZ. Here's what we know. We know that a team that Jim is on is experiencing burnout, and that's something we can intervene and help that team with. So all of the insights bubble up to the team level, to the group level. The insights do not live at the individual level. So you can't use software to pull up a report on an individual. Now, I have some executives that wish it did, but we've decided it's not going to, because that's an ethical line that we don't think is good. Our goal is not to call people out. Our goal is to shine a light, like you said earlier, shine a light on what the culture really is, so that leaders that care can get involved and fix the culture that's affecting people's real lives. The goal is for leaders to do better, not for employees to be called out. This is a tool for us to see what is true in the culture so that we can just lift everyone up. It's not a tool for surveillance. And so we've built in a lot of precaution so that ourselves and the organizations that use our software, they will never know what an individual is doing, because that's not what it's built for. And so it really is about insights, to use your user word, insights at the group level, not surveillance at the individual level.
Yeah, I think that a tool like that builds more trust than triggering fear. So basically what you're doing is AI is reading the room. And when the room's slack, does it ever pop up and say, oh, Jim's about ready to revolt?
No, it doesn't, right? What it would do, let's say you said something, you know, in Slack or in Microsoft Teams that, let's say you went on a tirade, you know, I hate it around here. Everything is terrible. I'm going to take some employees with me and we're going to leave, you know, whatever. You just had a terrible message inside of Slack. It would scan it for 1,226 signals that we can find in those six metrics. So it's looking at every message and saying, do we see one of these 1,226 signals? Now, a message like that would have a number of signals found in it, right? A number of negative signals would be found, but we wouldn't say, hey, this negative signal is associated with Jim. What it would do is it would say this signal, which is a signal of misalignment, because you're getting ready to leave the organization and you're not in agreement with anything. It's in a group that Jim is a part of. So this group has misalignment, but Jim doesn't have misalignment. And so we're looking at signals in those messages, but we're not storing the message itself. We're storing the signal that it finds, and we're bubbling that up to the group level. And so, yes, you would affect the scores of your culture by sending messages like that, but it wouldn't affect anything personally for you. It would just be a tool to increase the culture of that group.
I like that. Now, do you have some things that we talked a little bit about this, some things that you can show me? When you did a handout, it showed kind of a Slack and what a person was reading and then how the AI would pull things out of that. And then you talked about, I think there's 1,228 signals that you're looking at. But do you have anything that you can show?
Yeah.
You bring up
absolutely.
A screen.
Let me find it here on the slide deck really quick, and I'll work through a couple slides. And you're right, it is 1,228. I misspoke when I said 26. So let me pull up the slides here.
And while you're doing that, one of the things that I'm thinking about is I think that it is so important, you know, if you want to improve your culture, it's impossible to do that improvement if you don't have the data. And that data is so important to get, because if I go in and say, oh, well, you need some leadership development. We need to have some coaching. We need to have this training. A lot of times entities will come back and say, oh, yeah, we've been there, done that. We've got a good guy. This is our company that comes in. We send them off to a weekend seminar. And I always go back to that thing is, how do you quantify what you're doing is getting results? And this is the magic. You know, you can quantify that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll work through a couple slides here.
Okay.
You know, like I said before, workplace revolutionizes how we measure culture. That's the big idea. And we trained an AI on culture using peer-reviewed research. And so when we got into that research, we found that there's six core metrics. We've already talked about kind of how we came to those six. And inside those metrics, there's 1,228 signals that we look for, right? And just to reinforce it here, here's the six: alignment, employee engagement, psychological safety, execution risk, burnout, and conflict. But here's a really cool one. You can't read it, but on the right-hand side there, those are actually the 1,228 signals that we're looking for. And so we're looking for those signals within all of the different messages and language being used.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, we've taken a lot of time to get the AI to be able to do this. We built our own proprietary model to be able to find these signals of culture. But like we said, we were wondering, how can we measure culture without surveys? And that's when we had that insight. Any software a team uses leaves cultural clues. So we're able to look at the cultural clues inside of Slack and Teams and Zoom. And so we look at how people actually interact. So that's the difference. This software is not looking at what the values are stated as. They're looking at what the behaviors are. And I'll show you a really cool example here. So this is what you would see. Someone in Slack, they say, hey, Sarah, saw the new requirements you added. This is the third redesign this week, and now we're adding more complexity. I'll try to get done by tomorrow, but I'm working late again and honestly running on empty. The devs already think the timeline is impossible. That's what we see. But what's actually there is all kinds of signals. There's misaligned teams between product and dev. There's the fact that it was sent after work hours and he says he's working late. There is the potential to miss the goal. He says the timeline is impossible. There's the signal of negative sentiment. He says there's more complexity in all caps. There's burnout potential. He says, you know, we're running on empty over here. There's frustration detected. He said, this is the third redesign this week. And so if you think about it, these are just the signals in one Slack or Teams messages. So just imagine all of the signals that are there in all of the messages being sent in a given day, in a given week inside of an organization.
Yeah, that is just, I think that's amazing. I think this is a game changer for a lot of organizations. When you think about what's next and how you think about what is the next level of this, how do you see this playing out when a culture starts seeing what was invisible to now what is very observable?
Yeah, so that's a great question. You know, AI is not going to do the hard work for you, right? It's a dashboard. It's measuring things. It's giving you data. But now a human has to get involved and do something, right? And so as a leader, you can use this as a diagnostic, but it's not going to fix anything in and of itself. You have to then have leadership that looks at this data and has a game plan. So one of the things they can do is they can start designing their culture, right? We don't really think about it a lot, but you can look at the dashboard and you can see what reality is. And then you can ask yourself, what do we want reality to be? What scores do we want to be high? Where do we want to excel? And what kind of behaviors do we need to change to make those scores go up and to the right? So you can start having honest conversations with people and say, look, this score is low. My hypothesis is it's low because of these five behaviors. Let's work on changing these behaviors and let's check in next month and see if that metric is still low or not, right? So you're starting to design the culture that you want to be true, but you're not just hoping it's true by creating values, right? You're actually saying, no, culture is about behavior and this score is low. So what are the finite, definite, discrete, tangible behaviors that we can start changing, which is changing how we do things around here, that's then going to show back up in the data, right? And so you can just be proactive about how you design things. You know, as a leader of a large organization, you can see where groups need your help, right? You can see that, okay, this group is actually doing really well, but this other group over here, they need help. And again, it's not to call them out, it's to call them up. It's so you can get involved and help them understand the way you want things to be done around there, right? Maybe as a leader, what's happening on the ground is not actually what you want to be happening on the ground. And there's a disconnect there, there's a gap. So you can get involved and say, hey, this isn't how we do things around here. Because remember, I said, you know, culture is what we allow, what we do habitually and what we reinforce, right? And so you as a leader can get involved and say, hey, we don't allow that. We're not going to make a habit of that. And we're definitely not going to reinforce that bad behavior through incentives or other things. But a lot of times, you know, corporations actually have incentives that create bad cultures. And so you have to make sure that your incentives are aligned with a good culture. If you have a grow at all cost culture, then that's going to be hard to do and still have some of these things like psychological safety or alignment, right? And so as a leader, it gives you a dashboard to design the culture that you want to be true. And it gives you a way to go into the parts of the organization that really need your help, to get hands-on and to model for them the way you want to do things around there.
No, I love this. This is, I just love the way you're going with this. I love how your mind thinks. I think this is really, really good. Now, you talked a little bit about CQ, which is the culture index. You described culture index as the next evolution of IQ and EQ. What exactly is CQ and what happens when a company starts to develop it?
Yeah. So, you know, we all know IQ. Right? Mm-hmm. Intellectual quotient, You know, it's a measure of intelligence. Now, whether it actually measures intelligence is a discussion for another day. But, you know, as commonly understood, it measures intelligence. And we know EQ, you know, emotional quotient, emotional intelligence, and there's a measure of that. One that's in the business world that's very popular is BI, business intelligence, right? And we know business intelligence, it's where's the dashboard that tells me my stats, tells me how many widgets I'm making, how many are being shipped, what the downtime is. It might tell me my cash flow. It might tell me my, you know, expenses, but you have business intelligence to get your head around the operations. And what my team has been thinking about is, well, we have all these measures, IQ, EQ, BI, right? Why can't we measure culture with the same rigor? Because remember, we have these breakthroughs in natural language processing, and language is the programming language of humanity. And culture is embedded in that language. And there's six durable metrics to measure that language against. And once we started putting all the pieces together, we realized these weren't discrete pieces. These formed a whole picture that when you look at all those things I just listed off, that you could actually have a dashboard of cultural intelligence, or CQ, the same way you have a business intelligence dashboard. So you can log in as an executive and say, I have my BI dashboard. I have my CQ dashboard. They're both really important. You should know the numbers of your operation, right? You should know the numbers of your finances. But I would venture to say you should just as much know the numbers of your culture. And that's a new idea, numbers and culture. It's like, no, but culture's fuzzy. It's like, well, it's fuzzy if you want it to be fuzzy. It's fuzzy if you allow it to be fuzzy. It's fuzzy if you do things the way we did it in the 80s. But here we are with the breakthroughs of AI and natural language processing. It doesn't have to be fuzzy. You could approach culture the way you approach business intelligence. You can approach culture the way you think about finance or operations or strategy. See, when it comes to finance, operations, strategy, we want the numbers. Okay, tell me my total addressable market. Tell me my spend on the ad. Tell me, you know, you want the details. When it comes to culture, nobody says, just give me the data, because there isn't data. And so they say, okay, just tell me your feelings. Right? And so you end up with all these anecdotes kind of floating around. So we think that there is a discipline called cultural intelligence that gives a rigor to culture and defines it numerically the way we define business intelligence or other kinds of quotient.
I like that a lot. Now, when culture, when you think about it and it starts becoming measurable, what is the next frontier? Is it improving it or predicting it or designing it?
Yeah, I mean, it's all three. I mean, we talked about designing it earlier. Predicting is a big one though, right? Because in this software, you can see trend lines, and trend lines, they usually have a line of best fit, right? So you can see, okay, we were here, now we're here. What's it going to look like in 3 months if we continue this trajectory? So for the first time, you can predict out what the culture is going to look like if changes aren't made. And that's a wild idea. I mean, we think about modeling out finances and forecasting finances, forecasting cash flow, but we never think about forecasting culture. But now we could look at those six metrics and say, if we do nothing, this is where we're going to be in a year from now, not based on guesses, based on the line of best fit that is showing up in the hard data of our culture. So I think prediction is a really interesting space that no one's explored with culture before.
Yeah, I think you're on to it. Now, Bronson, I love this intersection. So it's when your science meets my mission, you know, so one of the things my work does is I'm helping leaders close the gap between what they say and how they show up. And cultural intelligence makes this measurable for the first time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Turning insight into data, you know, if you can't mitigate risk, or you can't mitigate risk if you don't measure it. And for now, for the first time, culture has really not been measurable, or it's been difficult to measure. So for the CEOs, the COOs, the HRs, and the chief people officers, how do they begin? What's the easiest first step for their culture to, you know, get in touch with what you're describing?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me back up and even talk about something you mentioned that I think is really cool.
Let's talk
about the gap between what executives want and what the reality is, right? And I think it's the gap where there's so much opportunity, right? Because that's where you can grow, is in the gap between what you want and what is. And so, you know, one of the reasons I love sports is there's just a scoreboard. Like, you know how the team is doing at any moment in the game, right? So you know if you should be excited, you know if you should be bummed. There's a score, and that score gives you the ability to have the correct emotion in the moment, right? And I think that's what executives want, right? And the other thing about a scoreboard is it's objective. Nobody gets to arbitrarily decide what the score is during a football game. You don't get to say, well, I feel like the score is 22-17. Like, no, you don't get to feel like the score is anything. The score is what the score is. And here's why that's important, right? Because it's the people sometimes that have the most power that want to tell you a score that isn't accurate, right? Because it's their organization, because they're the ones that have put so much time and energy into running that organization that they want to tell you, no, don't look at the scoreboard. Listen to what I'm telling you. Our culture is good. Repeat after me. Our culture is good. And then they're looking at the scoreboard and they're saying, we have room to improve. There's a gap there. And one of the things that I think shows up is the gap. A lot of times it's going to take a lot of humility from senior leaders, because a lot of times it's their own behavior that is the gap, right?
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier, how is it affecting us when we see this software running? And I didn't go into specific examples. And maybe that's because a lot of times it was calling me out as a CEO. A lot of the things that it was telling me about the group, I knew that it was my bad behavior driving that. I knew that it was habits that I had that were driving that. You know, one time it told us in one of the insights that it sent us that our team was, you know, we weren't focused, right, on the meeting. And that during meetings, we had other things going on and we weren't really paying attention to what each other were saying. And I realized that it sent that insight after I had been going through a McDonald's drive-thru during the meeting. I was distracted ordering food, and then I had to ask everyone to repeat themselves, right? So when I saw the scoreboard, I said, no, the gap is me. I was the one distracted. I was the one that wasn't really focused on what we were talking about. And it didn't call me out personally, but it told me, hey, your team is distracted right now. And I actually knew that the gap was me. And so the thing I love about this is it's a scoreboard, and it's a scoreboard for humble leaders to grow. Now, if you want to be a proud leader, I got nothing for you. I can't help you, right? You already know everything. You already know everything's perfect. You don't need any data. You do whatever you're going to do. There's no help for you. I definitely can't help you. But if you're a humble leader that's okay with the gap between what you want and what you are being yourself inside of the organization, then this gives you a scoreboard that you can really look to. I think the gap, some of the biggest gaps that you can find in an organization is in what you allow a high performer to do in terms of their behavior and what your stated values are. I think we turn a blind eye to high performers because we don't want to lose their output. We don't want to lose their sales. We don't want to lose their connections. We don't want to lose their influence. So we put up with them creating toxic cultures. And here's what's really interesting about that. We're afraid to lose them because we're on this quarterly cycle. We always want things to go up and to the right every 3 months. For whatever reason, that's what business has decided. But when you let people like that get in line with the culture, you create a culture that creates even more high performers. So by getting the high performer in line with how the culture should be, how we should do things around here, you create a place for other high performers to grow into their own. So you end up in 6 or 12 months with higher ROI, but you might see a dip in the short term because you are wrangling in a high performer and not letting them hurt the culture, right? I'll give you another example of this gap between the stated values and what we want to be true is what leaders do in public versus what leaders do in private, what they say in public versus what they say in private, how they think and act and talk about the organization in public versus how they think and act and talk in private. And that's a gap there. If we can lower that gap to be zero so that you just are who you are, you're going to see the culture come to life because you're actually living it. So I just love this idea, going back to cultural intelligence, that there's a real scoreboard and nobody gets to decide what the score is. The score is the score. And we're all in this thing together. Let's do what we can do to get this score to go up and to the right. So anyway, a little bit of an aside there. But you were asking, go ahead, you have something there.
No, I was just thinking about, you know, with the gap in the culture, and I was thinking, you mean like when your CEO is out at a concert with your HR person?
that would be one of them. Yes, that would be a gap. Absolutely.
No, I was laughing. I was laughing because you said you were going through the McDonald's drive-thru, and it, you know, to segue a little bit, I was doing the exact same thing, and one of my persons that was in the meeting knew that I was at McDonald's drive-thru, and so he started shouting really loudly the orders, and the McDonald's person was like, okay, 12 Big Macs, 15 fries, and I started laughing so hard, I couldn't stop them from doing that. So I'm just laughing about that. So
similar story.
A little bit of a segue there. So for everyone listening, you know, one of the things that I think is really, you know, Bronson, this conversation changed the way we think about leadership and culture in so many ways. But for everyone listening, you know, if you've ever heard the saying that culture eats strategy for breakfast, it's now time that you can start measuring what's actually on your plate for breakfast. So I think that's a really interesting concept. You learn about this through data, and data is so important. And I think that this workplace IO that you've got going and your book, The Science of Culture, is just a game changer. Tell me about what your vision is for workplace IO. Who's the company is going after? Is this going after, you know, the Googles and the Fords and the big ones, or is it designed for over 100 employees? Is it designed for small entities? Yeah. How does it work?
It's a really good question. When we first started developing this product, we had a hypothesis that it would be for companies around 250 in headcount, because our thinking was big enough that they've outgrown the ability to manage their culture. It's not 10 people anymore. The CEO doesn't know what's happening in every conversation. They've grown beyond that. They have HR. They're having to act like a grown-up organization, but they're not so big that they're interested in using AI and being innovative. So that was our hypothesis. That hypothesis was wrong. So in actually speaking with organizations, we have organizations as small as 20 people that are going to be using this within a month or so, all the way up to organizations that have over 100,000 employees. And so it really runs the gamut of interest, because what's really interesting is people are people. And culture is culture, and culture matters with 20 people, and culture matters with 100,000 people, and culture is how we do things around here. And that matters if you're a small group, and it matters if you're a multinational conglomerate. And so we actually found a lot of interest across the gamut of organizations, which we weren't expecting. We didn't know that such large organizations would want this or need this. We might have had this false sense that if you're that big of an organization, you've figured out the culture stuff, or how could you grow to be that big? But then when we actually work with them, they're the ones most desperate for it, because it's so big that they've lost their ability to know what's going on. And they not only have cultures, they have subcultures and sub-subcultures. So when the software can actually say, this is how Latin America is doing, or this is how one project team is doing, or this is how one account is doing, then all of a sudden they get visibility into something that they couldn't imagine have a visibility into. So I would say if you're an organization that uses digital tools for collaboration, right? So you need to be using Slack or Teams or Zoom. If you don't use any of those tools, it's probably not going to be a great fit for you, because again, we're doing natural language processing on the digital exhaust in those collaboration tools. But if you're using Slack or Teams or Zoom or other software like that, this is probably a good fit for you. And if you care about culture, it's probably a good fit for you. And if you're not afraid of the truth, it's probably a good fit for you. And I say that last one, I think it's actually an important one, right? Some organizations listening to this, let's just be honest, they don't want to know the truth. They would rather have bad results than know the truth about their culture. They would rather put up with turnover than know the truth about their culture, because then they got to look in the mirror. And you know what? It takes a certain boldness to look in the mirror and really figure out what's going on. Because as a leader, you're probably the reason it's going on or a big part of it. And so you have to be the kind of person that uses digital tools for collaboration, wants to know the truth about your culture also. But if anybody is listening to this and they're actually interested in, you know, becoming a part of our beta, go to workplace.io. So that's the word work, PLACE.io. Go there, and we have a wait list right now. We have over 40 companies that are waiting to use this when we launch it in about 30 days. And so go ahead and get on the wait list. And when we're able to, we'll reach out to you and figure out how you want to integrate this with your organization and give you demos, talk you through a lot of things like that. And on the website also, we have white papers that we've written around ethics and privacy and AI. We have white papers, one on from data to dialogue about how to use this to actually create dialogue within the teams that are seeing their scores. We have white papers on how NLP actually processes language to create these scores, because we want you all to have a lot of confidence in what the software is doing and a lot of confidence in how you can use it after you let it start running in the background, because this could be the most powerful software that an organization has had access to in a long time. And we want you to have a lot of information about it, and all that's at workplace.io.
Yeah. And I'll put that link in the description on where you watch your favorite or listen to your favorite podcast and on YouTube and everything. So that's going to be in there. I built out something called the Ultimate Leadership Audit with this intention, knowing that this was kind of in the back burner and coming out. So one of the things I want to do is be able to offer it, because I think when I go into an organization and we're talking about cultural or, you know, people development, which I do a lot of, it always starts with leadership. I think about communication. I think about all these things. But if I can start with a diagnosis and say, here's the diagnosis, I can do it through a survey, I can do it through observation, but here's the digital exhaust. And if we combined all three of those, plus insight on how to attack the problem and say, okay, this is our cultural index, how do we improve that? There can be a significant ROI that can be quantified, because I look at the payroll to revenue ratio or the revenue to payroll ratio and look at those things. And within different industries, it is different for different industries. But if I go into, you know, our healthcare industry right now, big challenge with turnover and the cost on that, if you're bringing in a doctor and it's, let's say, $400,000 with salary and benefits and malpractice insurance, and that doctor leaves because of the culture, you're going to pay either 6 months of that salary to a year of that salary before, you know, you get back to an even keel on what you've spent, you know, for having a bad culture. So I see there's real tangible costs in this. And that's the one final parting thought, you know. If you can summarize kind of an ROI on this, mm-hmm. I think it's just a huge, huge number on the ROI. Yeah. If you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm going to give you two different ways to look at ROI. Mm-hmm. One is the bottom line, right? And that's the way we normally look at ROI inside of an organization. And you know what? If you have a good culture, all the studies say this, that you're going to have lower turnover, you're going to have lower waste, you're going to have higher productivity. A study came out and said that companies with a better culture have 202% stronger returns than companies with a bad culture. And so across the board, we know that culture ends up on the bottom line. It ends up in the profit and loss column. It is a hard fact of doing business that your culture will end up on the bottom line. But let me actually introduce another way to think about ROI, is when you create a bad culture in your organization, think about what that bad culture does to the people that work for you, that work with you, that work alongside you, the stress they're taking home to their family, the stress they're taking out on their family, the stress that they're carrying into their community, right? When you have a bad culture, people have to use the weekend to recover, right? They have to use the weekend just to try to like get their head back to normal, because they had to put up with 5 days of really bad culture. And so on the weekend, instead of being engaged with their kids, instead of being a part of their family, instead of doing things they actually enjoy with a clear mind, they're replaying conversations from the week, right? And so the ROI on humanity matters also. So yes, it's going to end up on the bottom line. You're going to make more money. If you're only about money, you're going to make more money if you have a good culture, right? If you just want the straight throughput from culture to ROI, there it is. But I would say when you create a good culture, you're doing something more profound than you can ever know. You know, one of the things I teach people when I teach leadership is I say, if you're a boss of people, be really careful what you say on a Friday, because there's going to be people that think about it all weekend long. And you have a lot of power over the quality of their life for Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday when you're not even in meetings with them and you're not even a part of what they're doing. But they're going to take whatever you said, and if it was biting, if it was cutting, if it was negative, and it's going to roll around in their mind, and they're going to wonder, why did my boss say that? What does that mean? What am I going to do about that? And that's going to affect their entire weekend. I would say that's a pretty terrible ROI. We want people to have incredible lives. You know, life is good. We want people to enjoy their life. So why don't we create cultures that work? Because people spend most of their time at work.
I love that. And I love what your, you know, the book, you gave a quote by Edgar, is it Sheen or Shine or?
Yeah, I think it's Shine, but I'm not totally sure.
Shine, he's a former CEO of IBM. He says, culture isn't just one aspect of the game. It is the game. And I think that's perfectly said from the CEO of IBM.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Bronson, we've shared a feast. It's been so wonderful. Every time I talk to you, I just get so excited about this, because I think this is a game changer for, you know, this is a world changer. And I love how you ended this talking about, it's not just about the bottom line on the corporate profit. It's the bottom line on, you know, our whole world. You know, how do we make this world a better place? And I think that you're on a mission, and I think this product is one of those things that does that.
Yeah, well, Jim, I really appreciate you having me on today. It's been great interacting with you as somebody who's very enthusiastic about what we're building. It was great catching up with you a couple weeks ago, and let's do it again sometime.
All right. Until next time.